Again, apologies for that technical thing of not turning on the sound, but I did invite you all. Just wanted to continue what I was just saying. So to settle is the same root as lashevet, to sit. A moshav is a place to sit. It's also an agricultural cooperative in Israel, but to be on the moshav is to be in an established place to sit. That's why I would love to see if retreats were starting to be called yeshivot, places of yeshivas, because what is yeshiva has been always connected with people who are sitting and studying Torah. Get it? So you go to yeshiva. Of course, that has the connotation now that it's an Orthodox parochial school. But what they are doing too is sitting and hopefully settling into the fact that Torah is now their environment. And that's what we're doing. We're settling and getting into this place of silence, which is now our environment. But it's, as I say, not something that's going to take us away, but to actually put us inside of ourselves and the capacity to literally sit. Ashrei Yoshvei Veitecha, you know the famous psalm, right? Happy are those who sit in the house of Yah, and Yah being the world, being those who are happy are those who sit in the world and have the capacity to observe it. By the way, that collection of psalms, each one is a separate line. It's a realization of what happens when you sit and observe. And each line can be understood as an attribute of that capacity to observe what's going on. Of course, it revolves around the sense that there is this universe that we can appeal to in a way, appeal to. V'anachnu nevarech Yah, but we will bless this. V'anachnu nevarech Yah me'ata v'ad olam, from today and forever. Okay, I want to move into something else, and a few things, a bit scattered today, but I think some things that might be of value to us. So this last week or two in Torah study, we decided to, instead of reading the Parsha or studying the Parsha, Parsha Pinchas, which is about zealotry, we decided to read the Haftarah, which brings us into Elijah, Eliyahu. And Eliyahu, in some commentaries, is the reincarnation of Pinchas, the zealot. And the story of Elijah and the story of Pinchas are interesting because Pinchas, after his zealotry in stopping a plague based upon sexual depravity, he does it in a very visceral way by literally putting a spear through two people who are fornicating, who are people of high status. He then is rewarded with Brit Shalom, with the covenant of peace. Kind of bizarre. But if we go to Elijah, we understand it a little more. Now, the reason I'm into Elijah these days is I just finished a wonderful book by a good friend, which I recommend to all of you, by Daniel Matt, who is a master translator of the Zohar, a wonderful translation, which is very remarkable that one person did so much of it, a few other people helped. Anyway, he has a book called Elijah now, which is part of a series called The Jewish Lives, L-I-V-E-S, series from Yale University Press. And what you get from the story of Elijah is that he has many, many of the characteristics of what we would call a bodhisattva. And I was interested in the bodhisattva for a number of reasons, which I will get to. So Elijah basically remains a part of our ritual life in a very vivid way. Elijah appears in every Brit Milah. Okay? Elijah, sing to at the end of every Shabbat. Elijah shows up, perhaps the most well-known is at the Seder. Right? So, and Elijah is there in many other parts of Jewish ritual lives. He's one of the few, if you will, prophets or that basically have infiltrated into the fabric of Jewish life, and his existence as a model of many different attributes, bodhisattva attributes, become particularly well known in one chapter of chapter 17 of the first book of Kings, Kings 1, and then he becomes somewhat involved in Talmudic theology, then in Kabbalah, in mysticism, but most importantly, he becomes part of Jewish folklore. as someone who comes back. He never dies, by the way. That's what makes Elijah so interesting. That doesn't mention ever that he dies, that he reaches this pinnacle, and then he comes back. And in Jewish folklore, he's always there doing these bodhisattva things. He comes to always dressed as a beggar in rags. And he approaches, let's say, a house, and he knocks on the door, and he says, I have no place to stay for Shabbos. They say, well, we have very little. You have to sleep by the oven, and we have so little food, but we'll share it with you. And he enjoys the hospitality of this poor family. And then, of course, he leaves and disappears after Shabbat and leaves a sack behind. And in the sack is gold and silver, of course. And they are rewarded. Also, Elijah appears in one of the great motifs of Jewish folklore, which is the motif that was so prevalent. There's an evil force that's even emerging, and he fights off the evil force. The Esther and Haman story is such a story. And he's found not only in Ashkenazi, but also in Sephardi and Middle Eastern Jewish folklore. The reason I bring him up is because when I think about Elijah, I think about what is Elijah's nature. And then I went to the parsha of this week. I meander. I'm an ADHD kind of person, I guess. I meander. And the first part of our parsha for this week, Matot and Maaseh, it's a double parsha, which ends the narrative of the Torah ends. Matot and Maaseh. It's also my bar mitzvah parsha, so I have a very special feeling towards it. Not a positive one, but I'll talk about that at another time. But the beginning of the parsha talks about oaths, O-A-T-H-S, and nidarim, promises, oaths, or vows. And technically speaking, the difference between an oath and a vow, by the way, oaths and vows were very seriously taken. So the parsha says, if you take a vow, a neder in Hebrew, you take a vow, it is vital that you fulfill it. So the parsha talks about the fact that people who, without majority status or minors, if they make one, their father can cancel it. So because if they do not fulfill it, they will become there's a tremendous sense of trying to get the word disappointment, if you will, or a tremendous sense even of quote-unquote sin, whatever you understand it. So the neder is the thing that you won't do. So for instance, a nazir, which we talked about, sort of a Jewish monk, if you will, takes upon him or herself a neder to abstain from wine, a neder to abstain from cutting of the hair. Samson, for instance, was a Nazir, and he himself is the one who makes the oath. So the oath refers to the personal, and the neder refers to the thing that the person. So then I was thinking of vows. So my mind took me to something that I hope many of you know about, and that's called the Bodhisattva vows. You may be aware that there are vows that's particularly found in Mahayana, even though the Theravadins also have. But the idea would be that the Bodhisattva vows are things that take upon themselves certain attributes of concern for the world, of empathy and compassion for the world. And that assumes that many of us don't have that yet. And the idea that one is willing to dedicate one's life to that improvement of the world. So these vows can be taken. There is a ceremony or a ceremonial 1 month of vows. We could maybe say that's Elul for them, right? That's the month that they work on this expansion of compassion to the world. And then, of course, I was reading on and I found there were a couple of pieces that say that all of us are bodhisattvas, have the capacity to be a bodhisattva, and all of us have the capacity to take vows and to hopefully fulfill them. So you have to be careful about the vows you take. But the vows are quite, helpful because it gives a direction. It's like, now again, we have to avoid this just being a New Year's resolution. Everybody makes a New Year's resolution. They're going to start going to the gym. Everybody's going to start going to the gym. January 2nd at 9 a.m., everybody's going on a diet and going to the gym, right? And then it lasts about, 3 to 4 days or a week or two, and it's gone. But these are vows that we take that are very much to be internalized in a deep, deep way, showing our capacity for compassion and for concern for all beings. And I think that's what we do a lot in our sits. And I would claim that anybody or everyone who sits in a mindful way is taking on a vow of being a bodhisattva, of saying, you know what, my journey in this on this earth is to not only be for myself, but to be for others. And that's not easy for a lot of people, as you know. And that's why we work so hard on settling ourselves, of not allowing our ego needs to be what is primarily that motivates us. And I think that's really one of the great successful things of modern times, of current times, that more and more people are taking on the practice. And that practice, as I say, is the practice ultimately to nurture compassion. So in the Jewish tradition, as I say, we don't have vows per se, but we all make vows in a way. And that's what happens on Yom Kippur. We sing Kol Nidre. We absolve ourselves of these vows that we may have made, some through coercion, which was not an uncommon thing in the medieval period, where people were coerced in taking vows to another tradition in order to avoid being killed, right? Those kinds of vows, and also other kinds of vows that they may have made about their behaviors, etc., or some of financial vows that they made. So these vows are canceled, and there's a ceremony before that called Atarat Nidarim, where one goes to a court of three and says, you know, I really couldn't fulfill these things, even though I had the desire to do so. I'll try again as the beginning of the year begins. So what kind of vows can we make to ourselves? Should we make vows? As a matter of fact, there's an Orthodox custom, which I like, which when you say, I'll see you on Monday, you say, Bili Neder, without this being a vow. So if you have to cancel Monday, you have not transgressed your vow. So you say, Bili Neder, without a vow. Because vows are taken very seriously, as I said. Also, oaths are taken seriously. To swear, and I use the word swear not in a swear word, even though that's what it became. You know, oaths have become sort of negative, right? Oaths and etc. The oath basically was so powerful, the Shavuah, it's called Shavuah, that in a legal sense, if you, for instance, had a famous case, I'll just spend a little bit more time on this if you don't mind. If you had a very famous case in the Talmud, one of the most famous cases that most people have heard, two men or two people come across a garment, and each grabs the garment and says, this is mine and this is mine. And a dispute begins, and they go to a court, and they say, one of the people says, Kulo Shili, it's all mine. The other says, no, it's all mine. Okay. So what is helpful in that litigation is that the judge says, are you willing to swear to this? Now, what that does is it makes the person much more circumspect, because swearing was very, very taken very seriously. So if a person was willing to swear that this was all his or hers, then it was, because no one would swear unless they really, really meant it. But if they weren't willing to swear, guess what we do? Of course, you sell the garment and you split the money between the two, and you try to create that sense of equality. So the swearing was a very vital part of pressuring people to really speak the truth, because if they really, really meant it, then they would be willing to swear. And many people, because there was still a doubt in their own mind, is this really my garment? Garments can look alike, you know, etc. If that person's willing to swear with certainty, then that person basically should be taken seriously. Okay, so we're back to this bodhisattva idea. The bodhisattva also is a beginning of understanding what is known as Buddha nature. Buddha nature. And that is because the model of the Buddha was someone who had moved into a higher consciousness, expanded consciousness, some call it nirvana, and then had the opportunity of remaining there in a certain state of tremendous, if you will, splendor. How's that word? Splendor. I love that. And he can stay in splendor, right? And stay in love. Love is a many splendor thing. You're familiar with that. But chooses not to. He says, no, you know, this is like the Garden of Eden. We chose not to attach ourselves to the tree of life, but we chose to attach ourselves to the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. We wanted to attach ourselves to the reality that we see around us, and to be in a place of flux rather than only serenity. Now, you might say, if I had a choice between total serenity and getting involved in the world, I would choose serenity, but I don't think you really would. I don't think I really would. I think that would feel a little bit, alienating, to be honest, from what's really going on in the world. So the Buddha returns, becomes a model of the fact that people who are active in their practice reach a very high level of consciousness, and then they take that level of consciousness and make a commitment to go back into the everyday world and help others reach it. And I think that's a beautiful model. I think there's Elijah in nature as well, that we all have that capacity to, if you will, not remain, if you will, alive in for eternity in the heavens, but coming back into earth and helping teach, if you will, what it means to be truly a compassionate human being. So I really believe, I assume that, I try not to use the word belief too much, but I assume that the teachers in Buddhism that say that all of us are bodhisattvas, I think are onto something. I think that they really say that we all have the capacity to be people who will exude a certain kind of compassion which will inspire others. Right? This is particularly important to people involved in social action, by the way. In social action, one of the great things that I've often found is that people are willing to change other things, but not change themselves. Right? They talk about tikkun olam, right? The repair of the world, but they're not doing their own tikkun. They're not doing their own repair. And this is a real dilemma. It's often easier to say, I'm bringing others to compassion and not being compassionate yourself. It gives you an out. In a way, well, I'm doing great things, it's wonderful, but I haven't worked on my own self. And I think that's really what we all have to balance when we talk about changing the world, is can we change ourselves? And you're familiar with the old story, right? When I was a young man, I wanted to change the world, and I saw that was tough. I wanted to change my family, and that was getting hard. I wanted to change my community, didn't always work. And I realized when I got older, I should have started with changing myself. Maybe I would have been more successful in all the things that I endeavored to do. So I would suggest that we take advantage of this new season we're going into. This coming week, we enter into the so-called 9 days before Tisha B'Av, which are particularly days when people, or traditional people, don't eat meat and they don't celebrate things. It's sort of a mourning period or a pre-mourning period. And the way we've discussed it here before in our Nishmat Chaim community is that this is a preparation for the breaking down of the structures in our lives. The structures that hold us, some of them powerfully in a good way, and sometimes in a less than good way. And the Tisha B'Av, the destruction, quote-unquote, of the temple, is really the destruction of the temple we have built around ourselves. And that temple may often be something that takes us out of the world. That's what my take on it, our take, and Bobby, Sheila, and Reggie, we all have talked about this a great deal over the years. And then where you find that spirituality is no longer in a structure, but you find it out in the field. You find it in the field. You meet God in the field, and you start wooing each other again. So by the time Rosh Hashanah comes by, you've done a lot of work on yourself, and you give the opportunity, if you will, to say to God, I'll give God another chance. So we are in a process of forgiving each other, if you will, as we enter into this new year. So I would say that one of the things we could consider is small vows to ourselves, first to ourselves, you know, and then maybe extending it out there. But if we could use this season that's coming up, called the season of tshuva, however you want to say it, but of return, recalibration, however you want to understand. If we could use this season, and what will be helpful for us are making vows. I wouldn't say swear to them, that's tough, but making vows. And I like the idea, as the bodhisattva, they have an actual month-long ritual where people who are not monks, okay, take vows. Lay people take vows. It's similar a little in Southeast Asian Buddhism with in Thailand, for instance, everyone who, before they get married, takes a six-month retreat, if you will, and becomes a monk. The heads get shaven, and they wear robes, and they walk with their beggar bowls, and it's sort of giving them an opportunity. Like the Nazir that we had, the Nazir, who says, I want to take on certain things that the priest takes on without becoming, because they cannot become a priest unless they are born into it. So they take it on as lay people who are not born into it. So I brought you a lot of stuff. I'm sorry.